This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They were not very happy that their representative could not speak at the UN Assembly last month in New York because they sent someone there and he wasn't allowed to speak.
That's VOA French Service journalist Abdou Rahmane Dia describing why Niger's military government is demanding the head of the United Nations mission leave the country. Details coming up also. Ethiopian Jews in the United States worry about families in Israel. And Britain's king and queen will make a four-day state visit to Kenya. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Israel and Hamas continue to bombard each other's territory as fighting continues in the conflict that began Saturday when Hamas forces attacked Israel. Israel has responded, declaring war on Hamas, striking suspected Hamas and Islamic Jihad targets in Gaza. We have journalist Linda Gradstein on the line with us now from Jerusalem. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Linda.
Thank you very much.
So, as I said last Saturday morning, Hamas broke through. Hamas broke through the heavily fortified border fence with Israel, penetrated deep into Israel, killing hundreds of people, including civilians and soldiers. So, how has the Israeli response been so far?
Well, the Israeli response has been a very heavy bombardment of Gaza, a declaration of war on Gaza. And in Israel, there's really still shock. And, you know, it's hard to understand the extent of what this was. You're talking about a minimum of 1,500 armed Hamas gunmen who breached the border, who went into civilian communities along the border and killed hundreds of people. By the way, in the last few minutes, we're getting reports of a possible aerial infiltration from the north, not from the south where Gaza is, from the north where Lebanon is. And there's been some cross-border kind of skirmishes, and there's a concern that Israel could be having to face a war on two fronts, in the north against Hezbollah, which is, of course, a proxy of Iran, and in the south against Hamas.
And the death toll from the fighting continues to climb. Is there any number for today?
The number that I've seen, the total since the beginning, is at least 1,200 Israelis, including hundreds of women and children. And the number in Gaza is about 1,000, although it's probably much higher because it sometimes takes a while to get the reporting from Gaza.
So, the United Nations is saying that Gaza is facing a severe shortage of drinking water due to Israeli cuts. Your thoughts on that?
Well, so Israel cut off water and electricity to Gaza. The Gaza power plant is using the very last of its electricity. The truth is that Gaza was facing a water shortage before. The World Bank has determined that 90% of the water in Gaza is not drinkable. And, you know, Israel says its target is not the Gaza population, it's Hamas, but that Hamas, which controls Gaza, has, you know, is spread out throughout the Strip. So it's not clear. Also, I think it's important to remember that Hamas is holding between 100 and 150 Israeli hostages.
And like you said, Israel is now on a war footing and has already started mobilizing troops for a potential ground operation in Gaza. And one of the things Israeli intends to do is actually retrieve Israeli hostages from the territory. Fill us in on the hostage situation.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Israel has mobilized 300,000 troops. Israel's a small country, so, you know, of less than 10 million people. So 300,000 troops, everybody knows somebody who's been mobilized. That means, you know, leaving, you know, women are alone with small children, and it's a fairly complicated situation. That said, a ground invasion is very complicated. Gaza is, you know, one of the most densely populated areas in the world. I spoke to a terrorist terrorism expert today who said that if 1,500 Hamas gunmen were able to breach the border into Israel, you know, you're talking about Israel facing tens of thousands of Hamas gunmen in Gaza. There are behind-the-scenes back-channel negotiations for the freedom of the hostages, but it's not clear how many of them are even still alive.
And lastly, Linda, Hamas' operation was carried out in a sophisticated and coordinated manner and would have taken a significant amount of planning. There is speculation that the group may have received assistance from abroad. So could this lead to a wider regional conflict?
Right. That's the big question, you know, whether, for example, Iran was involved in helping Hamas plan this operation. And I honestly don't know the answer to that. That's obviously something that Israeli intelligence is investigating now. There were reports today that on the body of one of the fighters was an ISIS flag, but I haven't been able to confirm if those reports were true or not. I mean, there's a lot of disinformation, as you could imagine, going on both sides of this. That said, it's certainly possible that there was help from Iran, but I have no way of knowing. And, if Iran was involved, I think the bigger question will be, what happens in the region and where this fighting ends, whether it remains sort of focused on Israel-Gaza or whether or not it spreads.
Linda Grantstein on the line from Jerusalem. Thank you for your input.
Thank you.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Russia and the Arab League should contribute to ending the bloodshed and suffering in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. In a meeting with Arab League Secretary General Ahmed Abdougite in Moscow, Lavrov emphasized that it's also crucial to pay close attention to the factors that have prevented a lasting resolution to the Palestinian issue. Khalil Jahassan, executive director of the Arab Center in Washington, discussed Lavrov's statement with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi.
Instinctively, I would welcome any attempt by any world power to mediate or attempt to stop the bloodletting that's taking place, whether on the Israeli side or on the Palestinian side in retaliation. However, the last party that is equipped probably to play a positive role and mediate this conflict is Mr. Lavrov's government, in the sense that it is engaged in an unjustified war by itself, and it behooves it to try to end the fighting, and particularly the civilian casualties with regards to that. Number two, practically speaking, Russia, even though it has good relationship with the Israelis on the one hand and with the Palestinians on the other, I'm not sure it has the credibility to really make a difference with regards to this conflict. It hasn't done that before, and I'm not sure it will be successful at it. Third, the issue of the Arab partner. You have to have an Arab partner in any attempt to resolve this conflict in Gaza between Hamas and Israel. However, although in the past this has been kind of delegated, if you will, to just a couple of Arab players, mostly Egypt, because of security issues involved, the treaty with Israel, and the security arrangements between the two countries, and the relationship between Egyptian intelligence on the one side and Hamas leadership on the other. However, to go to the Arab League at this time seems to me to be idealistic and far-fetched in the sense that the Arab League is so polarized and so divided, particularly on these issues. I mean, there are essentially some members of the League right now that are probably happy to see this conflict proceed because of their animosity toward Hamas and toward any group related to the Muslim Brotherhood. So I can't see the Arab League as moving effectively at this time, even in partnership with somebody like, let's say, Russia.
So is there any chance to settle the conflict after the U.S.-sponsored peace talks were suspended for years now?
Of course, one cannot give up on the cause of peace. Peace is always possible, but there are requirements for peace. There are requirements that demand serious compromises from the parties. And if the parties are not, let's say, politically or psychologically at this stage of their common conflict, then you can't move forward. The problem with the demise of the American-sponsored peacemaking process in the region is the fact that it was never replaced. The U.S. continues to claim sole monopoly over it. It refused to bury the attempts of the past and to say that Oslo has failed, so let's see what else we can use to replace it with. And it's still insisting on returning to it. It's still insisting on the two-state solution, but it's not willing to spend the energy or pay the price for moving so. So it's encouraging to hear some positive, let's say, comments by officials in Washington about the need to move forward, and Palestinians are entitled to equal measures of dignity and respect like the Israeli side and so on. But at the same time, U.S. officials from top to bottom continue to tell us that the time is not ripe yet for such an effort.
That was Khalil Jashan, Executive Director of the Arab Center in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. The impact of Israel's conflict with Hamas has spread far and wide. The Better Israel of North America Cultural Foundation, BINA, is dedicated to fostering the continuity of Ethiopian Jews' culture heritage, providing assistance to Ethiopians within the American Jewish community, and serving as a bridge for the Jewish, Ethiopian, and African American communities. Bijay Barhani is the executive director and founder of Bete Israel of North America. She first talks about the impact the Israeli-Hamas conflict is having on her family in New York and in Israel.
You see, I grew up in Israel. My family, all of them are in Israel. They are impacted by this situation. Of course, people from the nearby, the kibbutzes, the different small kibbutz, people had to flee. They've been evacuated because they couldn't be there. It's a devastation, a lot of horrific, terrible thing to people. People been slaughtered. While going to a music festival. I don't know really how to describe it, but it's devastating to see how what they did. Nothing justifies that. There is no need to go to that level of barbaric act and kidnap and rape and kill little kids and old people.
Is there a light at the end of the tunnel whereby the peace will come back?
In the whole, everywhere, every corner of the world, some chaos is going on. We have to pray for healing and peace. And, I would like to be hopeful that there will be some agreement and negotiation that would be beneficial to both sides. That's my hope. We need healing in this earth. It's really devastating to see people, innocent people, suffering from both sides. It's very hurtful to me. And I hope something good is on the horizon after this lowest level that could be. And I hope there is something on the horizon, something positive that will bring for building, healing, and negotiation and so forth.
Where in Israel are you from, and what are you doing right now in present in New York?
I originally from Ethiopia, but I grew up in Israel all of my life. Actually, some of the kibbutzes, Kibbutz Alumim in the south, I grew up there. I have family in Ashkelon, which been bombarded as well. So I am from a little bit of everywhere in Israel. My childhood was spent in a kibbutz in the south where people had to evacuate from there. And currently, about 25 years ago, I emigrated to New York. I am owner of an Ethiopian restaurant, and I form a nonprofit organization by the name BINA, Beta Israel of North America, for educating about the rich history of Ethiopian Jewry and for dialogue and diversity and inclusion between the Jewish world. So that's who I am.
Talk to us a little bit about, it used to be known as Falashas, but not anymore. It's Beta Israel, right?
The term Falasha is a derogatory term that was given to the Ethiopian Jews, the Beta Israel. We prefer to be called Beta Israel or Ethiopian Jewry. Beta Israel, the meaning is the house of Israel. So I formed the nonprofit in New York to bring a better dialogue and understanding of the existence of Jews of color, Black Jews throughout the diaspora by doing showcases, film festival, and eventually that led to opening Tion Cafe, where I can showcase and celebrate the rich cuisine of Ethiopia as a whole and have a glimpse of the rich history and flavors that we have to offer to the world.
And lastly, what do you think about what is going on in Gaza right now with all the bombings and the citizens right there are no electricity, no water?
No innocent people should be involved in this. And unfortunate when there is a conflict with terrorist group and the army and so forth, the innocent people who are suffering. Nobody should be suffer in this kind of scenario, but what can you do where you enter and you enter a war? It's unforeseen situation. It nothing justified the innocent, the suffering of innocent people, elderly and children in this situation.
That was Bijay Barahane, Executive Director and Founder of Bete Israel of North America, speaking with me from New York. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The military government in Niger is demanding that the head of the United Nations diplomatic mission leave the West African country within 72 hours. It is the latest development since a coup in July toppled the democratically elected president and led to France withdrawing its ambassador and starting to pull its troops out of the former French colony. Abdurrahman Nadia of VOA's French to Africa service spoke with my colleague Carol Van Dam and describes what led to the junta's latest demand that the UN personnel leave Niger.
There have been some unease by the junta regarding the UN because they were not very happy that their representative could not speak at the UN assembly last month in New York because they sent someone there and he wasn't allowed to speak because the international community mostly still recognizing Bazoum's government as the legitimate government of Niger. So they basically accusing the UN representative of playing a role on this situation. So I guess that's really the main reason that we have seen as being the reason why the junta decided to ask her to leave.
The move comes after the French military said it too is leaving Niger. Is there any sign that the French are leaving as we speak?
Yes, the report was saying that the soldiers, the special forces based in Walam at the border with Mali and Burkina Faso have been leaving and headed to neighboring N'Djamena in Chad, which is basically the best way for them when it comes to taking the road. So, yes, it is confirmed. It is the beginning of the French troop departure. The French, up until recently, did not recognize any decision coming from the junta. So this is a first step. We have at least 1,000 troops in the capital, Niamey, the French troop, that also are supposed to depart the country before the end of the year. And some it will involve a lot of logistical also departure, which is, I think, the troops in Niamey are the big ones, the troops and the logistics also.
Do most people in Niger seem to back the junta's efforts to remove foreign diplomatic and military personnel, like we're seeing happening with the French troops from the country?
We don't have any scientific data because it's a country of more than 20 million people. But based on what we are seeing on social media and also in the capital, it looks like they do have the support. What's going on in the rest of the country, it's hard to tell. But at least in Niamey and really in social media, it looks like the junta has the support of many people, you know, in the tension with France mostly and also the UN, and they seem to be backing them. It's hard to tell what's happening outside of Niamey and those who maybe don't have the means to speak publicly.
The coup happened in late July, which removed the democratically elected president, Mohamed Bazoum, from power. What's the latest on Bazoum's whereabouts and that of his family?
We know that Secretary of State Antony Blinken have spoken to President Bazoum recently, and the U.S. and many countries are still demanding that he's released from custody, basically because he is still being held by the military in his residence. It's been a while since we really don't have a lot of information about him, but it looks like he's still able to communicate with other people.
That was Carol Van Dam talking to VOA's Abdurrahman Dia. More than 25,000 illegal migrants are estimated to have arrived in the United Kingdom by boat as of October 2nd. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has vowed to stop the boats as a top priority to curb unauthorized immigration. He wants to send asylum seekers to Rwanda, and his Conservative government is challenging a Court of Appeals ruling that says Rwanda is not safe for them. Lawyer, professor, and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, John Makum Mbaku, says it seems cruel to treat people, some of whom spent several years traveling across the Sahara Desert to reach Europe, back to Africa, to a country they don't even know, to a government they don't even understand.
The people who came to Britain are waiting for their applications to be processed. And the idea is that you send these people to Rwanda, and then the applications for asylum in the UK could be considered while they're waiting somewhere else. And Rwanda is one of those countries that volunteer to take those people in. One of the things we have to consider is that once those people leave the UK, they are no longer under the protection of the UK legal system. The UK legal system is a national legal system, and the laws in the UK protect people in the UK, not people in Rwanda. You're looking at two independent countries, two sovereign states. One state cannot dictate law in another. There is a danger that once those people arrive in Rwanda, their legal rights would be completely different because they would be dependent on what the law is in Rwanda and not what the law is in the UK.
And that's exactly, Professor, what the attorneys for the migrants are saying. They argue that there is a real risk their clients could be tortured, punished, or face inhumane and degrading treatment in violation of the European Convention on Human Rights. And they cite Rwanda's history of abusing refugees for dissent.
That is true, because once they leave the UK, they are no longer under protection of UK law or other treaties to which the UK is a signatory. It is true that Rwanda is a signatory to a lot of international treaties, like the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. But you know that in many African countries, including Rwanda, the fact that a country is a signatory to an international treaty doesn't mean that the treaty would be honored within that country. I mean, we've seen that in many countries in Africa. What is critical is the nature of the judicial institutions within that country. How independent is the judiciary in Rwanda when it comes to the protection of human rights? How dominant is the executive, that is the presidency, in terms of judiciary enforcement of human rights? And Rwanda doesn't have a very good history. Even post-genocide Rwanda does not have a very good history of enforcing human rights. So I really doubt that sending those people in Rwanda would be equivalent to leaving them in the UK when it comes to the protection of the human rights.
Besides the human rights thing, Professor, even if the courts allow the policy to proceed, it is unclear how many people will be flown to Rwanda at a cost of estimated to be £169,000, $206,000 per person.
Well, it beats the imagination, because some of the people in the UK are arguing that the government does not have the facilities for those people to stay while their cases are going through the courts, and that would be cheaper to do so in Rwanda. What I don't understand is where the economic calculations are coming from, because the process of deporting those people to Rwanda is quite expensive. And in addition to that, the Rwandan government is not accepting those people on a gratis basis. The government of the UK is going to give Rwanda money, and I think that's why Rwanda is accepting them. The money aside is the humanitarian aspect of it. The fact that this seems to be very cruel to treat people who, some of whom spend several years traveling through the Sahara Desert and finally finding themselves in Europe only to be sent back to Africa, to a place where they are not used to and to a government they don't understand. This is not very, it's not wise at all.
That was John Mukumumbaku, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.